Hello, and welcome to Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshanworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformations. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures.
As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they're reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated. They're being replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I'm your host today. I am Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm the former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. And previously, I have expertise in policy and finance. And my expertise lies at the intersection of economic trends with technology and innovation. I am delighted to welcome my guest today, who is Jasper Roos. Jasper is a renowned international authority in the field of innovation, transformation, and trends. His experience spans running a corporate innovation unit, launching digital ventures. He has led and contributed over 100 digital innovation and transformational projects in different industries throughout the world. And he's considered as one of the pioneers in topics such as corporate innovation, human-driven cultures, wearable technology, and crowdfunding. Next to entrepreneurship, Jasper is an avid writer on disruption and transformation, amongst others as columnist on the Dutch Financial Times. He's a frequent keynote speaker at events all over the world, and he's an advisory board member of several institutions like hospital incubators, large energy company, and one of the largest Dutch non-for-profit foundations. He's also an expert innovation member of the OIS group of the European Commission, and he is based in Amsterdam. Jasper, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. That was a long introduction about myself.
Well, there's a lot to say. You have a long and distinguished career, so hopefully I haven't left anything essential out. But Jasper, you're a computer scientist, you're an innovation expert, but you also have a unique approach to innovation. And perhaps that's why you have held some of the most interesting professional titles that one could arguably aspire to, such as Chief Inspiration Officer and Chief Enthusiasm Officer. So I've given you a brief background, but can you start by giving the audience a brief overview of your professional journey and how it shaped your thinking?
Yeah, well, so I'm the product of my mother is an artist, my father is a chemist, and they both come from analytical and creative sides. So they met up at a pool. And so I'm like a combination of the two of them. Of course, that's, I have the flesh between the analytical part and the creative part that I've always had in my life. So I wanted to go to acting school, but my mom then told me like, hey, you're probably not good enough just to me make it to the top, because she was actually that good. I said, like, why don't you use your analytical brain? I've always been in limbo between like at the left and the right thinking. And to I always felt like it was a little bit ambidextrous because I'm left-handed. But my dad always told me like it's better to be right-handed. So I tried to understand also like what the norm was, so to say. So in the end, I decided to do something in need with computer science, like understanding also how economy works. I did that, did my master's. And so I started my own little companies around training and helping out organizations to innovate, to digitalize. And so at the turn of the millennium, around 1999-2000, so I ended up with our mobile bank, which was back then like one of the top 10 banks in the world. And so everybody told me always, don't become a banker, because there's so much not like you. You're so much an entrepreneur. I was like, well, that's proves it wrong. Again, it was always my left, right side fights inside myself. So that for 7-8 years, I traveled the world to different places for the bank. And then I decided, because it's just, and it was at the brink of the 2007 crash, the big financial crash. And then before that, like in the summer, I decided to become a writer. and as an author of books, because I wanted to become Ernest Hemingway, and not writing The Old Man and the Sea, my favorite book, but then The Young Man and the Sea. As you can imagine, of course, I totally flunked at it. Within weeks, I thought I had this divine inspiration from bankers to an author on like fictional characters and epic novels. And of course, I'm so bad at that. It's just like, it's as I wanted to, it was in my head, but it was not in my hands, let's say. So then the bank asked me with a group of people to say, hey, why don't you, we need some bankers just to help us like redefine the future, because we know stuff is going to happen. And we know we need to redefine like a culture of, and like an important industry element, and we need to do that. And it was before the start, of course, of the financial crisis, and that, of course, changed everything. In the years, so I accepted it gradually to say, okay, I will do this. If I can do my own research and have like own team, if we can just do stuff with just writing like beautiful reports that nobody reads. So then the bank has taken over, was back then the biggest, maybe still is, financial takeover in the world ever. So different banks got nationalized, like the English industry got into, or economy got into big turmoil, the Belgian one, Dutch one, so all kind of nationalizations. And so it was a pretty heavy time. Lots of books have been written about that. And the funny thing for me was, because I was so close to the board with the group of people I'm working with, so nobody bothered. Yeah? So as long as you stay in the eye of the storm, nobody cares. So we did all kind of crazy stuff as a kind of vagabonds, which is now very common, but back then was really just interesting, like redefining how an industry should look like. So that I've been doing for 6-7 years, and beginning with more like taking over and investing in ventures, later on developing it ourselves. And a lot of beautiful things came out of that. That's what we now call like the Apple Watch. And we created one of the first prototypes with that. And we thought it would be called the peripheral and our auxiliary documents. Of course, we didn't know it would be wearable. We did crowdfunding. We created concepts for our bank for sex workers. And so we did all kind of stuff that was like silly, crazy. It was not to be silly per se, but it was more like to test stretch our minds. And so what are the paradoxes? What are the challenges, the tensions which are in society, and how can we learn from that? And how can we create new products that are also inclusive for everyone? So after 6-7 years, I had several investment funds and digital agencies. So someone good, someone bad. Of course, I've been doing this for all of my life. And I've always been moving, teaching, working. So I used to also a lot of times in the Asia, in, for example, like Mexico, where they teach a lot of universities. And now it's typically my focus areas like Europe and the Middle East, where I try to travel frequently to. So that's for me, that's my short my life. And so people indeed know me as the Chief Inspiration Officer, which was a funny title. It's actually a funny story, and maybe this describes a little bit how I was. So when I wanted to write the book, The Young Man and the Sea, so I created my own silly company for that called the Inspiration Academy, because I just thought to myself, hey, let me be the boss of my own little joint. And then, of course, I became also in ABN AMRO Bank, back then a very corporate banker, of course, like what we know about bankers, that was the culture as well. And I had my own, had allowed them to do my own research and my own set of work next to it. So I gave a lot of people like hope on what can you do if you're stuck in your job, if you're stuck in the wrong career, what can you do? And of course, that was my prime example for myself. I wrote a lot for Psychology Magazine, was sort of like how to become a slasher. And like during the day, the person is this, and in the evening, he or she becomes. And so I did it a lot, and I got like really noticed in the society for that part. And then my team said, we should call you, and everybody called me, I was the Chief Inspiration Officer, also in the bank. And so also some of my colleagues and my secretary, my PA, I don't know who it was. I think it was Miranda, my secretary. She said, I'm going to get you some cars. I think it's the Chief Inspiration Officer. So that happened. And as you can imagine, we did like really stuff that hit the economies, the Forbes, the Fortunes, everything around the world, all stuff that we did. And then people wanted to, press agencies wanted to call with the CAO. And you can imagine the CAO of such a big bank was called like a proud man, of course, in his 50s. That's the typical image you can have of a CTO or CAO. And of course, they were always a little bit disappointed, especially, of course, the CTO when he said, no, I'm not talking about you, I'm just talking about innovation, the cool stuff. Huh? I gotta talk to Jasper. But at a certain point, I got a call from the CEO, which was like our most known finance minister, guiding us through the crisis. And he said, what the beep are you doing? Like, why are you using these names? Hey, so for me, like, inspiring people is much more important than innovating and changing itself. And so if you give people the motivation to do that, it's good. And but again, I'm not like a teacher or a guide that will just do everything. I was just like, have follow me. And so do as I say, don't do as I do. I'm trying to poke people and to get them going. To poke them and to make sure that they get it, what they are going for. So that's my inspiration. That's the chief inspiration officer. And just the chief enthusiasm officer comes from, so from my chief humor officer research that I've been doing for many years. And the funny thing about that was, when I was still a banker, so we got all these beautiful reports, all these leadership coaches, of course, how you top-down manage like the crowd and how you should do that. Certain point, people came with servant leadership. There was the rise of servant leadership and all collective leadership models. And I didn't get it, like, why are we doing it? Because what you saw in theory was not the stuff you saw in practice. So I said, when I got hired again by the bank with the managing board, I told them, I want to do my own research on something I care about. And what I see with my kids and with what they do is like the power of humor and playfulness. And of course, as you can imagine, the bank was like, okay, I don't care because that's just such a silly thing. Nobody cares about that. So you can do it. As long as you do your work, if you deliver your KPIs, we don't care. And of course, they didn't know what would happen out of that. So that's the research is called Chief Humor Officer. And for many years, we've been and still doing that researching on what makes people tick. And so one of the, I think, the key issue that we now see in these days, of course, everybody wants to ride the tech boom and ride the tech wave of new initiatives coming. And of course, this is like the new gospel of tech companies, of course, saying that use your AI, use your tooling, and life will get better. And we forget, of course, that in the end, a lot of people actually don't know how to deal with it because they're afraid of that, or they don't know how to adapt to all these new messages coming in our face or new tools that we should be using. And so that's what I, with my team, try to work upon. It's like, how do we deal with it in a playful way? And because people have the fear, and for a lot of reasons to be afraid right now in society, but there's also a lot of ways, if we can focus on that, how to make the world a little bit better, and then also to change what we want to do. So it's in theory, I think it would be called dialectics. So yeah, so because you have contrasting things, black and white, or left and right. And because you create this tension, which could be just a paradox, or it could be a dilemma, or could either be a trilemma that you have to choose, that makes us go forward. And that's like actually what we do in our daily work.
And it's excellent. This gives the audience a much better sense of your approach to innovation also. This really brings to your experience to life. I'm also glad to see that we have something in common, because The Old Man and the Sea is also my favorite book. And I was in the financial sector in a bank in London at the time of the global financial crisis. So I can easily relate to your stories. So yes, but you've done a lot of work with different companies to try to revamp their innovation culture, coming with the very idiosyncratic approach you just highlighted. So I'd like you to discuss a little bit, what are some of the key roadblocks to innovation that you have encountered in your experience with companies? And in our previous conversation, you had mentioned, for example, the role of taboos. What uh-huh. are those? What do you mean?
Yes, so if we now talk about innovation, as a non-innovator, for people who are non-innovators, it's typically perceived, for example, innovation as something like innovation theater, or something that you put in a lot of money and then it's like inshallah, or then the magic happens, and then sometimes you get something out of that. If you see like the plug and play San Francisco type of people that say, hey, we're going to make like unicorns. Yeah, I used to work also for the plug and play. And of course, it's, and let's make this financial value growth engine, which is out there. But as you can imagine, a lot of times it doesn't happen. And so innovation is difficult on the one side, because we don't understand what the profession is. On the other side as well, because a lot of the things that we think that we want to work upon is only what everybody else is doing. And so you see a lot of innovation right now, which is on digital and on AI. And so the thing is, if you really want to create like innovation that sticks to people or that people perceive as something new in the market, then it's difficult. So you have to be at the rim of society, at the rim of your business model, at the edges to understand it. And it's a daunting place. And it's very interesting to understand what's out there. But just give you an example. Right now in the market space, Tether, like as a stablecoin, is very popular. And that's a very popular stablecoin right now. And of course, but if you dig deep, of course, you can talk about the mechanics of Tether. But the actual reason is that almost all drug lords and Colombian cartels are using Tether. And so it's interesting to see that, for example, those markets are using stuff that they may be illegal in some areas, or I think drugs is illegal in 99% of the hard drugs in 99% of jurisdictions around the world, but it's illegal, and that they need to find a way to make money. And they're very effective at that. Actually, I think like the all kind of mafia organizations are very effective. And funny enough, so they don't have any issues with communicating. And so typically, everybody knows from the boss to the don, the local people are running around in the streets, they're doing like bad stuff. They know what they need to do. And that's funny because we have, of course, in any kind of like organization, we have an ideal fashion in which we have a dialogue instead of a discussion. We're not considered as bosses, but we're considered as coaches and all kind of leadership styles. But actually, that's a model that works as well. And you don't need all that stuff. Yeah, it's the same, of course, like in a lot of Navy SEAL kind of environments. Yeah, the leadership is much more like a group collective and everybody just knows what they need to do. They don't need to talk. So I like to look at what are the taboos and the errors in the market where we can learn from. And so a lot of the payment models or like the ways we do video comes because it gets derived from the adult entertainment industry. And so they needed to find ways to make money. And again, I have so many examples of that. The way we watch video tapes that got popular. It's simply because of those markets. So if we take it to a bit more like normal perspective, as in not like those edgy markets, because then people may say, oh, Jastri is promoting these kind of markets. So I give you an example. It's a funny thing. So I'm inspired by graffiti. And so I like to go to these places where East meets West, or like where everything gets a little bit edgy. Like it used to be, for example, in Williamsburg in New York. And so those 10, 12 years ago, and you saw the rise. So a little bit of gentrification. And it was not like fully safe to walk around, but it was safe enough. And of course, if you would act normal, those people would just living there and nothing would happen. And so one of the things I got inspired by back then is the graffiti, of course, the colors that they use for companies like Pantone, just imagining what kind of color is hot and what color is not hot, like the bread color, which was hot in the summer. And those colors typically have been used by graffiti artists like the year before. And these are very much weak signals. And so what I started to do, just fast forward to the story. So I started to use stickers, because that's also a way to communicate. It's a fast way of doing that, to connect it to the desire in the innovation world to say, you can fail. So let's say in the 90s, it was impossible to fail. Everything was like General Electric, Jack Welch winning. Those were the days. Like I win, you lose. At a certain point, you saw Tom Peters and some other people talking about failing. Failing is okay. Later on, you had Steve Blank and stuff on experimenting, but failing was okay. But if I say to my kids, it's okay to fail, if then my daughter would crash my car, I'll say, oh, that's not what I meant. I meant something different. I think you're like your mindset, but not doing. Anyway, so that is a problem. So we, in a way, we say to people in innovation, oh, it's okay to fail. But the moment you feel is, so what I started to do is just to make it clear, because everybody says, no, I'm a very servant leader. So we created stickers. And we created stickers which had funny messaging on it. And to say to them, okay, if this is an entrepreneurial culture, and that means failing, yes, do I agree? Yeah, yes. Okay, have a sticker. Let's put it on your laptop. I cannot do that. Why not? There you go. Yeah. Yes. Or I said, put it on, or I have stickers like boss office. Here only the boss sits. Then I put it on your table. Yes, but I cannot do that. Facility management will disagree with me. So where is it? So that's the funny thing. And there's, of course, it's Richard Wiseman, all kind of professors have been writing about that. That's a bit of the neuroscience part where I'm getting into. We just assume that there are certain rules. And that typically makes us innovate inside a large organization, conforming the rules. And so we have this outside world of startups, garage boys and girls, who of course then create the next Apple. But that's apart from whether it's a myth or not. And that's, of course, it's an outside world. Hardly any company has been able to really get that market going on the inside as well, on the conforming side. And that's because we have a lot of like rules inside an organization in which you assume things. And so stickers for me was like, it's just an example of stuff I saw with guys, ladies, just people who were just making signs on roads. Of course, that's forbidden. It's typically not allowed because you demolish it, of course, unless you're Banksy. Because with Banksy or Obey or these kind of artists, it's great. So I was taking a little bit of that. So why do they do that? And so a marketeer never got it. Because then when I showed marketeers on trend tours in London or in Berlin, they said, so why is this micromessaging relevant? Why don't we do it on the internet? And I had to explain them, of course, like when everything becomes ubiquitous, and if someone then can read your sign, it's like very clear. And I find it fascinating. You see this, for example, in the fashion industry as well. As for the big brands, the Cartiers, the Dior's, typically you cannot buy the stuff online. And so they are, of course, ubiquitous everywhere. But you cannot buy it like a Zara or an H&M or whatever kind of big brand. So what I'm trying to do, and again, coming back to those, is I try to understand what are taboos in the markets that I see. And what can we do with that? Because the taboo is typically hidden for a certain reason. And typically because society, something became popular, and after a while, it's like an Atlantis. So it more or less, we know we should not be doing that, but we forgot about it.
There are a couple of elements here that I want to get deeper into, because they're very interesting. Because one is the issue of the taboo is also connected to the issue of the stronger financial incentives. So when you mention whether it's the porn industry or it's the mafia and the drug industry, these are areas which are illegal. So they're taboos because they're illegal. You can talk about it and there's a social stigma, but they're also areas where the economic incentive is tremendously powerful. And therefore, there's a very strong push to find the most efficient solutions. So that's one piece of it. So you've highlighted the importance of looking in those areas as well. Then you've also highlighted the importance of trying to create mental space, even from a neuroscience perspective, for people who are in corporate organizations to break the rules. And I've noticed when we were offline earlier, I pointed to the sign behind you on the bookshelf saying in Italian, I broke the law. So, and the importance
it's from an artist, actually,
the importance of being able to understand when and how you can break the rules. And that now, so the first part is interesting in the sense that you go and look in the taboos where you can find the best practices, and then you figure out how to copy or imitate them. But in established corporations, how far can you go by just shifting people's perspective and telling them, look, you can put a sticker on your laptop or on your table, you really should feel comfortable with it? And how far instead do you need to push it beyond that and persuading organizations to do something different? In other words, creating innovation, true innovation within a big corporate structure, is it just an issue of changes people's mindset, or does it require to change the incentives, to carve out a piece of the corporation that plays by different rules? How is it done?
Yes, I think that, as of course, people like to, of course, to see change. And I want to see innovation because it's popular. And whether it's called innovation or transformation or AI nowadays, of course, because that's, of course, we don't talk about innovation, we talk about AI. But typically something gets thought about at the headquarters. So to say, the big towers over an headquarter. Again, I'm mocking it a little bit just to make it because they have the responsibility as the captains of the organization and to steer it in the right way. So for them, it's really difficult to see what's happening. And so I live in the Netherlands, so Heineken is like a Dutch beer brand. And then Heineken is actually a person. Freddy Heineken was like a known like beer guru. And he said, always when I go to a factory, I smell the scent of paint. I love it. That's to me like beer and paint always together. He didn't know, of course, when he would come down out of his headquarters to the factory, everybody, of course, cleaned it and painted the wall so it would look nice. I said for him, I said, that's, so for headquarters, really difficult to understand. You need clowns for that, of course, jesters who then tell them it's actually not the case. So for them, it's really difficult. So imagine, for example, that we talk about like AI introduction. And so everybody sees potential and everybody, of course, wants to ride that bandwagon. And because if you don't have like investors or shareholders, you probably have stakeholders who then say, we should think about that. So 7-8 years ago, you started, for example, with ethics. And then everybody thought, of course, it was crazy. Like, why would you, Jasper, you're a digital guy. Why would you not talk about the borders of, so you're crazy. And now, of course, it's different. So anyway, so with ethics, so with AI, what you now see, and which I find interesting, so we see the tools are very easy. Like 2 years, of course, ChatGPT came along, and it was, of course, this big wave. Everybody wants to do that. So headquarters says we should be doing that because we can automate. And they get strategic reports, of course, saying we can cut costs and we can do this. And of course, cutting costs is always easier than creating revenue streams because that's more fixed. And so what you see is that in the end, a lot of people, what they forget, is a lot of people in the factory, whether the blue-collar workers or they're like the office personnel that actually have to do the stuff, may not have a company email address. Or they may have like fears because we see a lot of fears with technology usage. And so people say, yes, I can. But I don't know. It was until Corona. Before that, video calling was not a corporate routine. And because a lot of people said, I'm not using video. I don't do that. And then, of course, they had to. So that's why it became popular. But it was like a taboo to ask people to turn on your video, especially when you would do interculturally. And so what we now see in organizations, and the reason is pretty simple, because transformation doesn't work right now. And because we create, and of course, that's the habit of from top to down, and we create beautiful reports on end visions, what should be done, done perfect, great, and everything is perfect, designed. And then we realize that people need a little bit of like stickiness and roughness to make it their own and that they can discuss the fears. So what you see, for example, right now in like retail stores, so the people working in the retail stores, I mean, like 80% of like an organization, like Macy's or whatsoever, so typically they cannot use the jammer or like the internal internet or whatever kind of tools. So they don't read all these beautiful new values and new like initiatives. And so for them, it's like, hey, somebody is imposing this on me to do that. And thou shall not do this or that. Or you shall not jaywalk. And people are like, why should I do that? What you see, a lot of transformation fail. Again, like for me, that's one of the reasons I'm so curious about that, because there are a lot of blockages that people have, but they don't share. And it's really interesting to get them behind the secrets. And again, that's for me, like when everybody goes right, I go left. And that has been my behavior in my child as well. And now it helps me because I try to understand why people are like where some outlaws are doing stuff, but also why most people just now follow the herd, but in the end, don't do it. So what we have been doing, and of course, that's part of my research, what I've been doing, for example, putting slides in the office. And of course, a slide doesn't have any function other than that we then have a dialogue on, what does it do? Why is it there? So, for example, it's this beautiful effect. So once we did all kind of pimping of coffee outlets, like water outlets, and it's based upon the science of the water cooler effect. And so the water cooler effect is what you have seen with Googles and Facebooks of this world, is that in the 70s, IBM was not doing well, or the 70s, 80s. And then the bosses told their employees, sit behind the desk. And I had to do the monkey work to show that we're actually involved, that we're actually doing stuff, because that was considered work. You have to do it. When I was a banker, I just had to walk around with lots of paperwork and have many meetings. It showed how important that was. You never saw a boss that says, come into my office. It was always like, I'm busy. Like, I'm busy. And so they found out that when the people moved away from their job, had the actual desk, and they gave themselves like water cooler, or coffee or tea or smoke or whatsoever. Actually, they cleared up their mind. And that's, of course, that's a neuroscience part there. Of course, we get like a dopamine shot, and because we reward ourselves. And we'd be completing a thought, we got it. And of course, it made us do better. And so in the beginning, the IBM bosses told them, like, move back. You're taking too much time. Later on, they found out, because people took the coffee or the water, after the water cooler, they actually started to relax because it was rewarding. So their brain came to a relaxation. And then they start to chat with people. So it was, and again, like, I'm fascinated by what people do when, of course, they get stuck. And so right now with AI, that we see a lot is that people actually don't know. And so people say, yes, I can. And yes, I should also think about AI. But they're fearful. And so people, when they create a change plan or an innovation plan, they forget that actually people who don't know or are fearful that their job may end. So what you see right now in retail stores, all the employees need to tell them, use your phone for scanning or like the apps or use the self-scan service. But they forget sometimes that those employees may be fearing that their jobs may be on the line. And so that for them is asking the turkey, what would you like to have for your AI Christmas dinner? And so a lot of AI, of course, developers don't work or not going to work because they forget that the people who actually have to do, and I'll call it a blue collar worker, like actually have to really be in the service contact, may think it's like it's different. And I cannot
explain. I'm jumping in here, Jasper, because there is something else I want to ask you about AI. You pointed out the fear that people can have of AI. Oh my God, AI is going to take my job, is going to replace me, and therefore I reject it up front. There's another element to it, though, which is, especially with generative AI, the ability that we now get to receive easy answers. And I'm linking it to your example of the water cooler, because part of the value of the water cooler is the serendipitous interaction. You know, you and I meet at the water cooler, we exchange ideas, what's going on. And then once I know you, if I'm wondering about something, there is some information that I need, there is something I don't understand, I'm more likely to pick up the phone and call yours, come and grab you, let's get a coffee, let's discuss. And that's how ideas get generated. Now, should we be concerned that with generative AI coming online, that instead people are going to be more tempted to, again, retreat into their own cubicle, because whatever I need, I can ask ChatGPT or another AI engine? And are we going to lose that element of serendipitous interaction, or instead are we going to create different kind of water cooler effect, which includes the AI?
Yeah, so a beautiful question. And it connects really well. So like a news message I saw like this week, like the Oxford 2024 word is brain rot. And so apparently we're suffering from brain rot because everything that we now do is at the tip of our fingers. And in case we have to go to the toilet, we bring our phone with us. And because it might be that we just have to think for 3 minutes with our own thoughts. And it's so easy. Our brain just like the 50 second, like all the kind of hits that we get, dopamine hits. And like changing stuff that you keep on mentioning that. We have forgotten the art to go deep, right? Like a Plato's cave, to really go deep and think about what you want to become. So I'm 100% with you. And of course, that the tools which are out there do not work. And of course, it is good that we can use it. But of course, we have now, we call it prompt engineering. But in the end, of course, we already know we're going to ask it to a ChatGPT. And because that's the least resistance. Least intrusive, because you might just call them. So what I do is one of the fun things, maybe also for the listeners, I do this on a daily basis when I'm driving. It was typically only call when I'm driving. I call just a random person out of my phone. At first, I know, of course, because I registered in my phone, and I call them. And it's so funny, because when I talk to them, and of course, that's serendipity. So and I said, hey, how are you doing? If they ask, of course, but assuming hesitantly, because people, if you call them, they're like, hey, what's happening? So if you're actually calling me on my cell phone, so what is wrong? And it's so funny because people are like, oh, nothing. I just want to hear how you are. And it's just like, people just, it has become a taboo to call people without a reason. And you should always have a reason because they ask, so what is wrong? So I'm pinpointing at that. And of course, you can imagine, yes, I did this with an English guy I knew. Abbe had not talked about him with him like for a year or 2 years. We're the same kind of group of people. And so I know he asked friends about me a couple of times, but we did not really talk. And I was with Paul kind of reasons I did not take the effort to call him. And so yesterday I gave him a call. And he was just like, really like, it's so great to talk. And so the serendipity, we need to reinstate it on purpose. And what happened, of course, like in the good old days where we did this, because we're just at the office and then that finance department was far away from the sales department or from whoever. And now, of course, everybody is created equal and everybody seems to be happy working day in life, but everybody feels very lonely. And most people feel lonely. That's a big topic that comes back, of course, from the COVID times where we feel lonely and not connected. We want to become a collection. And banks and companies and corporates need to solve that because our work is optimized individual, but it's totally forgotten like the art needs to come back together. And so that's not only like the physical space, like the water cooler, but it should also be included with the serendipity. And that you sometimes just do things because you can. That it doesn't, and it's like crazy, like everybody would say don't, and then you say, why not? And I think that, so for me, like the one of the most important things which I do, and which I tell people when they use AI also in organization, first, like a Russian would do, think about the question, write it down, and do what they care about. And then if there's computer power available, then use the computer. That is at least how I know the story why, especially Eastern European engineers are so smart in coding, because they did not have the computer capacity in the 60s and 70s. So they first had to write things down and use Lisp and Prolog and all the other complex AI languages to really make it work, not the Python, but the higher degree, I'll say coding languages. And so you had to use logic. And again, I have it a lot as well when I have a dumb question, I just use the phone editing and ask it to ChatGPT or to all the other ones, the Perplexities to pose and to this world. But we have to be wary. So where are we using it for? Because we have gotten to, Bing, okay, we don't get any answers. To Google, you get a lot of time answers. To ChatGPT, a good answer, but then the question may be wrong. And therefore, of course, we have seen this market in front engineering. But indeed, what you're saying, so we now always get a good answer on a question, but we've forgotten that we should not ask everything to ChatGPT or to any kind of LLM, because they cannot, of course, you cannot blame the tool for that, but it's not for serendipity or creating breakthrough innovations.
No, exactly. We forget, as you pointed out, that sometimes the problem is we don't know what question we should be asking. And exactly. That only comes up as you have free-flowing conversations. Otherwise, if you go with very narrow questions, you will get narrow answers, but even if they're precise, they will not get you much further ahead. Now, yes, but in your experience, you've advised a number of companies. What are some success stories? What are some examples of companies where you've seen that, yes, there is an ability to move the needle, to really improve the innovation environment?
So I'm not necessarily here talking about certain brands, but more I can give the characteristics of brands that I find successful.
Absolutely.
One of them, of course, that they allow multi-brand thinking. And of course, that's just simply put there, because that's multi-brand thinking, what I'm trying to say. Of course, you have a corporate brand, which most organizations need, but allow people to also to innovate in their own space, maybe with a sub-brand or just to get it going. And most typically, the satellites in organizations, they create the change in the core. As at the core, you can only do like incremental, lean process, Lean Six Sigma, which is really important there. Business improvements, also innovation or change. It's really relevant to do that. But if you really want to get like hardcore innovations, and if you don't have a research lab, it should come from satellites. And typically, a research lab is also a kind of like a satellite. Because typically they have different kind of rules, different kind of KPIs, different kind of like ways of working. Yesterday I was around the Philips environment. Philips, of course, a great birthplace of a lot of tools, which is now ASML, like the second largest company in Europe, but the key leader in the chip industry. for the machinery. And so what you saw is they had a lot of satellites and they were like connected, but not fully connected. And so they had their own stuff. A bit like Madagascar, where you see all the beautiful animals, or because it was not like fully to the mothership. I think that's one of the things that you see is if there's room to work, that's good. And that's on the hardcore side. The second thing I would say is that so we should be more and more thinking not necessarily about the hardcore innovation, but more about the mindset that needs to be done. And because we now everybody has this Intel insight or AI insight or whatever. So the way we can all do in the iRobot Asimov based movies, because we're all like humanoids or we're all droids right nowadays. And so I can cheat with you in a normal conversation. It will take more time. If it will be a job interview, I could just get the answer in all the time. Like, oh, let me think about that. Again, I'm not doing that right now. Hands on the table. But it's really the serendipity, the synchronous communication. And I think that's... So what you see inside organization, and let's, for example, something I admire in an organization like Amazon, as I said, the saying goes, I said, whenever you do that, whenever you sit together, you first have to read. This is actually a topic on Taboos, which I'm discussing with someone. And I sat down with him yesterday and I gave it to him. Like, okay, let's first read this. This is my work that I've done to get this going. This was actually on Taboos in the tech sector with AI, is now to overcome them and how to understand them. Because that's if you get the roadblocks out of the way. And I said, let's sit together and let's read it again. Because then we have a common understanding. And just let your mind shut up. I'm not going to talk. You're not going to talk. Because then I will intrude your thinking process. And I don't expect it, because this is a busy person, I don't expect it that you have had the time to read it. And let's do it now. And if you do this like for 10 minutes, it's good, because then 50 minutes or whatever time that we had allotted, then we can sit together. And I think that's the mindset that we want to do. I really hope, of course, that with Scrum and agile ways of working, of course, you've seen it trying to happen. And then we say, okay, we should on one side have like short talks, like 15, 20 minutes, to be able to free up the time to have like deep talks. And so I guess also like I'm, of course, one of the people who love like long talks like you are organizing, because it goes a little bit deeper than just like the 3-minute TikToks or 3-second talks, maybe better. And so we need to have the depth to really be different from other ones. And again, these are all, and you could call this paradoxes or taboos or way tides of the size of the times. Yeah, I get all of that. But again, I think if most organizations would think like a marathon runner, and we just say, hey, you don't need to sprint. But then if I want to do a marathon, I can be prepared. I can do all the stuff. But if I then, for some reason, I have a pebble in my shoe, I cannot walk fast. Everything I did for training, for implementation, it doesn't work. If the pebble is in my shoe, I will not run faster. And for me, these are like the unlocking of items. Yes, it could be like an obstacle. And it could be about stuff that we need to do. And again, I call them this generic way, call them like taboos or like obstacles. And the only way we can do that to unlock them is to show light upon them. But a taboo is, again, is hidden for a reason. And so that can only really disclose it in a good way is by having some fun around it. Because otherwise, it's typically, there's a reason why it's hidden, why the family secrets are hidden. So you cannot talk about them. And I think I had this talk yesterday or the day before on an integration of a unit of a company. And it was like set apart and then it got integrated in the organization again. And the person I was talking to created this beautiful integration plan, change, innovation, blah, blah, blah. But I thought like, this is too beautiful. And these people came back because they were satellites in the organization and they have to be reintegrated. So for some people, it's pain. And for them, it's like, hey, they have to go back because they lost. They didn't lose, but like, yeah. And for the other one, they're like the victorious one. Like, he didn't make it. So we should have, and I thought, like, we should have time for that pain. We should describe the pain. And of course, in the corporate world, we never have pain. There are pains and gains, but on the individual level, we don't talk about I loss or whatsoever. And I think that's really interesting. So one of my favorite quotes is from Mr. Elop. He was the Nokia chairman, or CEO, pardon me. And so when, of course, Nokia was one of the case studies for innovation, hardcore, radical innovation, transformation. And so his quote, of course, at the ending of his press conferences, he said, we didn't do anything wrong, but we lost. I may say it the other way around. So they lost, but they didn't do anything wrong. And I think that's, I find that beautiful, is that, and so we also, like when we do like an integration or, so we should talk about these pains. And the way that we didn't handle that is with, of course, being open and sincere, showing empathy, yeah, like Brené Brown, like stuff. But also we should have a little bit of fun of that. Like the playfulness, because in the end, what you see, when I coming back also to the my approach typically to innovation, because the boost is the unlocking part, one of the areas to do that. And to get ahead is like taking the lubricant of change, and it's typically energy and humor and fun or playfulness. That's typically the best way to move forward. If I look at kids, of course, they ask the questions. They create new combinations because they don't care about the rules. They don't know that you should put stickers and stuff. They don't know that you should ask your dad, like, why is the moon blue? I don't know. Oh, wow. I don't. Why you always are so strong when you're like, also. So cut off when you're just working? Good question, actually. Because they don't care, because they're just like, they are really curious. And of course, we've forgotten that. And I think what I've been learning and what I've been applying a lot, whether it's on neuroscientific principles, I've been introducing that stuff. And as I have, for example, been using scratch cards for organizations to help them learn, because they were like, typically from a headquarters or learning development, it's a big push. To say, thou shall innovate, thou shall be more digital, thou shall be more ethical or diverse, inclusive, all kind of official trainings. And so I knew, of course, that the results from those efforts, these big crusades on like some stuff, never worked out. Or maybe people pass the test, but nobody really uses it in practice. Because do as I say, don't do as I do. And that's like a big, of course, an issue. And so one of the things we started to introduce is scratch cards. Because typically they come to me, these kind of organizations, because they're saying, I don't know, because like it should work. McKinsey looked at this, Deloitte implemented this, it should work. But it doesn't. So what does it, again, I'm not mocking them too much, of course, because they are a great source for business for me. So I'm happy that actually they do it the way they do it. And typically was what they, so this is an example of scratch cards. So there was one organization we worked for. And they had a big, new values that they needed to come up with. And the values were very strong, very new. But of course, nobody cares in an organization about corporate values. Yeah, branding does, the CEO does, because he or she wants to set a new landmark. I think, and this is what we stand for. And everybody else, okay, whatever. What else do we need to talk about? Oh, no, now it's in my KPIs to be more trustworthy or to be more, again, so I'm mocking it a little bit. So nobody cared. So then they hired like a lot of like top-down bootcamp sessions to talk about that, leaders to managers, and it didn't work out. So they came to me because they realized that 80% of the people typically are the non-headquarter people. And again, I'm using this on purpose, the headquarters for the satellites, like the ones who come up with the plans and the ones who have to execute that. That's my... And so they said, we cannot reach them. Because again, all the time... And so those people are the receiving end of the technology or the message. So if they use any kind of Trello, Slack, or if at all, they're on the receiving side of it. So typically they don't read it, they don't do it. And of course, they have all the time the feeling like Buhika, bend over, here it comes again. And let's wait for the next strategy to happen. So we started to use like pub quizzes for them to learn about that. And to do story contests, like storytelling contests. But also use scratch cards. Okay, and because what we did, and of course, it's all neuroscience that I'm applying in practice, as we know that if people actually do an activity, it sticks. And if you do it a couple of times, it sticks. Of course, it's complex in organizations because you can't do this from PowerPoint. PowerPoint doesn't work for that. And you can push it, but people are like, oh, they're for PowerPoint. And so what we did, we created scratch cards. And of course, the head of sustainability went furious. No. We cannot use paper. And I told them, I was a customer, business customer of them. Like, I get at least like 10 emails per month from your business account alone. So every email is a jewel. And like, wow, I want energy, a unit. And so if I would count all the emails, I probably got 1,000 emails for you, which I don't read. Imagine you need to learn like all the like the steps on, for example, developing new values, because there is a reason, of course, why companies do that. Right? There is a reason why they want to create the culture change. And so when we did that, we had the platform behind that could connect the stuff. But what we saw, where everything is ubiquitous, like AI, digital, everything non-AI, that's what people start to pay for now. And so we created something that people had to do. I find so fascinating. So, of course, AI is now, everybody's investing in it, but only a few people are making money with that. And of course, now there are parts who do this, but like 95% of the companies, they are not tech companies and not like the software-based companies. They will not make money, they'll pay for it. So if you want to win the game of business modeling, you should think about that. What is it? That's something that we would say as an organization, we don't take data. Again, that's a blasphemy, of course, in the church of data right now, because otherwise you get Hell's Paradox, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, the robot star L starts to hallucinate. And so I find is really interesting, this tension that we have, like the right-wing people, so to say. I'm not talking about American politics here. And for me, as a left-handed person, I've always had to deal with, I was always a minority in left-right-handed, and just to try to match that. And again, so that's what I see in organizations who embrace that. And by not by having a top-down kind of structure, but just letting it be. So when we did research on the humor, we saw that humor, of course, the people only care. So my humor is different from your humor, from NASA's humor, from the Chinese government humor. They all have their own sense of humor, which is good, because then they have like their own kind of jokes to get it going. And so we know that if people have fun together, and it creates better results. And because they just, if they trust each other, they can say, hey, Marco, this could be a little bit different. You don't say this in a very formal relationship, because then you are not allowed to do that. But if you have a little bit of like space, then you can talk about it and you can share ideas, right? What the good effect? You can only do this after you get your dopamine shot and after your brain gets out of stress. The humor is the lubricant for changing that. And if we embrace that with all kind of like levers, then we see that people get into this mindset. So I know the most successful boards of directors that do that actually do that. And the other ones see that. I have one story Bill Gates. So it was this big banking conference in Boston called Sibos. And it was a Swift. There's one name I can name. Swift, of course, as every now and then you hear in the public, if a country gets cut out of Swift, they're in trouble. So Swift is very formal and very strict, of course, because especially 10, 15 years ago, if they broke down, it's like the internet breaking down and nothing works anymore. And so the marketing director asked me, yes, but I want to have a little bit of change into the organization. But the stuff you're going to do, you have to call it like executive presentations. So on my invoice, I said executive presentations. I said, you cannot do anything else. So funny story. So I did stuff. Amongst others, I created stickers for this very formal organization, which amongst others says, hug me, I'm Swifty. Swift is a company, and they put it on, and everybody loved it. There are two stories that emerged from that. So one of them, the CEO of Swift was a BCG guy, a strategy consultant, and he just saw me, and they said, Jasper, that was you, right, with the stickers. You know, I would have never allowed this analytical stuff, because I know you're a scientist, but like, the stuff you're doing is just like crazy. Second story, and it is true, is in the same round of events. 1 hour later, Bill Gates did the closing speech, and he came on stage and said, guys, this is what I call innovation. This is just like changing the rules by doing something different. Because we could only, how he ended the story that he started there. Of course, in the end, what Bill Gates did was radical. But he started, of course, by just in a way to say, hey, honestly, why is everybody doing it like this? Why can't we do it like that? And it's just, of course, that's not that the movement is more like a scamper kind of way of doing it. Like, why do we always do it like that?
And exactly. No, that is fantastic. Jasper, that is actually, it's a great note to end our conversation on, because it's such a perfect example of the power of humor and the power of bending and breaking rules and doing things differently. So it's fantastic. I think you've really opened up for our audience a completely new perspective on how to innovate, but also how to approach work and life overall by having more fun. I think the emphasis on fun is the one that I would stress the most. So thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great discussion. I hope you've enjoyed it as well, and I'm sure our audience has. Awesome. Kaspar Roos, thank you again, and thanks everyone for joining us today. Please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and you can always learn more and apply to be a speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everyone.
Goodbye.